Hello, welcome to the Bolotour Podcast, where we explore the great outdoors. The Bolotour Podcast is sponsored by Bolotour, the backpack and outdoor gear company like no other. With unique products like the Bolo Tarp, which is a backpack that opens up to a tarp that's also a hammock, that's also a gear organizer with pockets. It's also a pop-up tent sidewall. It's also a drain tarp, and that attaches to our Bolo Cooler or the Tactical, the Duffel, the Day Pack, and many others. So you got to check it out at bolotour.com. That's B-O-L-O-T-O-R, bolotour.com. So whether you're hiking through the highest peaks or wandering through the city streets, Bolotour's got your back. So be ready. Be on the lookout. Bolotour. All right, let's get on with today's journey.
Dr. Bill Miller, we're talking in the pregame, and he lived in Encino, my hometown. He did stand-up LA Cabaret, the place I first learned it. You're a seasoned doctor and a seasoned comedian. I'm just a ham and egger. But I'm so thrilled to talk to you about your career, because what I love about it is it's got its own thumbprint. But also, I want to get into, you know, your hiatus that you did, you know, for your kids and all that. This is very dynamic. It's very, very, it's not tied to a lot. So let's go back, though. Let's go back. Are you from Chicago? Where were you born, and how did you start stand-up?
I was born in New York. There until I was 10 and a half. Then my parents moved to Los Angeles, so I had no choice. I had to go with them. At 10 and a half, I couldn't fend for myself in the subways in New York. So I lived in L.A. for a while until I was 22, 23, and then I went to medical school at Northwestern. Then came back to L.A. and did an internship, a surgical internship, and started working emergency rooms. All the while, I wanted to be a comedian. You know, I remember when I was a kid, I used to watch the comedians on the Ed Sullivan Show. And I used to wait, you know, until the comedian was on before I went to bed as a little kid. And, you know, I wanted to do it. My parents kind of urged me toward medicine. So, yeah, it might be a good thing to do. So I didn't want to disappoint them. So I kept on doing both. And then I remember the summer before medical school, I used to go to the Comedy Store every night, you know, and I would go literally every night as an audience member. And then I started, you know, the guys would see us and then, you know, you go out after in front of the Comedy Store, they're all hanging out. So I started talking to a few of them. And then I said, you know, I always wanted to do this. And they said, do it. So my first Christmas vacation from medical school, I came back. And I remember signing up it was Monday night. It was amateur night. You know, I signed up. I got 5 minutes. I wrote some jokes. I got some laughs. And I was hooked. That was it. So I got to do this. And I went back to medical school, you know, after the Christmas vacation. And I found there's a newspaper in Chicago called The Reader. It was a free newspaper that had all the what's going on and, you know, young people's newspaper. And they were talking about the showcase clubs. So that was the start of the mushrooming of comedy clubs, you know. So I went to those and started meeting other comedians. And that was it for me. That was absolutely it. I was 23. Yeah. And the people that were hanging around the Chicago comedy scene at the time, Tom Dreesen was the patriarch. You know, he had already started going, you know, to the next 2-3 levels. And he would come back into town and, you know, go to these showcases, Marshall Warfield, Brad Sanders, O'Brien and Severa. You know, there were some pretty, you know, people that eventually became pretty big in the comedy world, Jimmy Allen. So I started doing that. I started working the comedy clubs, and then eventually they had the Comedy Womb and the Comedy Cottage in two suburbs in Chicago. So the comedians would get, you know, you get two shows a night. You go to one club and then drive over to the other club. You get 15 minutes. And then when I went back for summer vacations, I was working the Comedy Store and the Improv and started going from there. And then, you know, you just keep on going one foot in front of the other, and someone sees your work, say, hey, you want to do some colleges? Yeah, okay. So we started doing some college tours and things.
So you started doing college tours, and how long, when did you start doing that? How old were you then?
I was probably when I was after medical school, so 27, 28, something like that.
go to medical school, start doing stand-up. Now, when do you start, how do you segue into being a practicing doctor, and how does that look like? Were you doing it at the same time, or what does that look like?
I was doing it at the same time. You know, I started working emergency rooms, and I would do very low acuity places. Like, there was an industrial clinic, you know, like in the middle of Commerce, where there's a lot of factories. Back in the day, there was a lot of factories.
In LA, Commerce, LA.
Yeah, Commerce, LA. And if people got hurt, they would go to the industrial clinic. You know, if they had an industrial accident, they got a cut, a laceration or something. So I started doing those. And then when you start doing those, there's other emergency groups that would cover higher acuity places, but still not like Cedars. You know, there's a whole gradation of what kind of hospital. So I started stepping up, and then, you know, you have to do these CMEs, they're called continuing medical education. So you have to do those. And I started reading all the literature, and I went to some conferences, otherwise you lose your license. And as I got more and more proficient, I started working in higher and higher acuity places until I started working a couple hospitals that were fairly high acuity. You know, you get trauma off the road, you know, you wouldn't get much penetrating trauma, but you got a lot of blunt trauma. You know, it was out in the desert on the way to Palm Springs. So all these guys on their ATVs, and back then they were three-wheelers. I don't remember it. You know, and they're all riding around, you know, most of them have like a six-pack on board before they get on these things. And, hey, how you doing? Then they flip the thing over. You know, they break something, so they come into my hospital. So I started doing that. All the while, I did emergency medicine because you could, you know, do 2-3 shifts, and then you got 2 weeks off.
Wow.
And you come back and then do two, you know, but they were 24-hour shifts. So, you know, I would do a shift Monday, Wednesday, and then maybe Friday, and then I'm off for 2 or 3 weeks. And then I can go on the road, you know, do it at comedy clubs and, you know, God, I went all over the place. I mean, the clubs in Seattle, San Francisco, all the San Francisco area, you know, the Northern California area. There was in San Jose, San Leandro. You know, they went to Texas and Oklahoma City, Seattle, like, you know, New York, Boston, so Florida, you know, did a lot of clubs.
The writing process, you know, when you're running through the day and studying and doing your medical continuation studies, you know, I mean, I guess that's not all the time. That those comes in waves. So you did have downtime to where you could write during the day and perform at night?
Well, you know, I was not... in those days, a very disciplined writer where I said every morning, and I think a lot of comedians were like that. You say, okay, today I'm going to write for 45 minutes or an hour. Mm-hmm. You know, you go through life, you go through your day, and all of a sudden something comes to your head. And now I take the paper and pen out, and I start, you know, making some notes on it. And then in those days, a lot of comedians, we go, you know, we travel. There'd be three of us. There's a headliner, an opener, and a middle act. And we'd all be sharing a condo back in those days, a comedy condo. You know, a lot of clubs had that. You all share a car, you share a condo. And so you sit around all day with comics, you know, you're shooting it. And then, hey, I got an idea. What do you think of this? and back then, the comedy clubs, it was, you know, now it's not like it was then. Back then, it was Tuesday through Sunday. You know, sometimes Wednesday through Sunday, and you're doing one show Wednesday, Thursday, two Friday, sometimes three Saturday and one Sunday. So you're doing 8 to 10 shows sometimes in a week. So if you have an idea on Tuesday or Wednesday, and if you're ready, if you were, you know, vigilant and disciplined on your craft, you could come up with a minute by Sunday. So you'd go on the road for, you know, 2-3 weeks. Hopefully you come back with 2 or 3 new minutes. You know, and that's how the writing that I did most of the time. Now, you know, years later, I get up in the morning and I do my routine like everybody does in the routine. So, and then I come and sit down by my desk. I just read The War of Art, which if you haven't read it, it's The War of Art, Stephen Pressfield.
Wow, what's that?
It's it's a book on how to unlock. Let me see. I think I still have it here. It's right here on my desk. I just read it. I underlined it. I don't know if you can see this. I don't know him. I don't know Stephen Pressfield, but a good friend. But a good.
And when your inner creative battles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because a good friend of mine, Adam Ferrara, said, Doc, you got to read this book. So I did. And he's right. You know, as a creative person, we have a lot of resistance in our mind. You know, he talks about how to get creative and how to block out your blocks and then let the creative process flow. So lately, I've been getting up every morning and sit at my desk. And I found that once I start writing at my computer, you know, I'm typing. Once I got an idea and I start typing, all of a sudden my fingers keep going, even though the thought that I wanted to write about is gone, but something else is coming up. So I guess it's like, it's that discipline of tapping into your subconscious where all the good stuff happens.
Right.
A lot of bad stuff happens in there, but a lot of good stuff happens too.
Right. And when you wake up in the morning, that's when you're writing. Many of this in the book, your mind's a little more opened up and freer and more creative. Isn't that true?
I think so. You know, but I have notes during the day, and I have my phone with voice memos, and I'll get a bunch of those and I'll listen to them, and I'll listen to 10 and I go, oh, how did I even come up with these? But two of them go, oh, that's good. And those are the ones they start writing about. And then, one thing leads to another. And, it's not like 4 hours a day I'm writing, but, if I sit there for half an hour to 45 minutes, you come up with some stuff. And then I got to find a new material night at St. E's or, Laugh Factory or somewhere in Chicago where I can go up and try it. And that's, as you know, as a comedian, you may think it's funny as, can we curse? You may think it's funny as shit. And you get up there and the crowd goes, what? So you go, okay, it's not funny to them. So, that's my process now.
Yeah, and I find for me also, I'm not doing stand-up right now, but, late at night when your subconscious is kind of rested, and, you're just flying, you're just not censoring, and early in the morning, that it's interesting, we don't talk about that enough, that, your creative mind and because it's such a psychological thing. And at that point, there really is no substitute for stage time, which adds another part of the unconscious competence that you end up getting, with the writing process and performing, like performing.
Yeah. There's like a pilot needs airtime. A comic needs stage time, period. Right. It's an exact parallel. And if you don't get the stage time, I write some of my best lines riffing on stage.
Right.
Because your subconscious is, when I first started, there was a comedian in Chicago, Paul Kelly. And he said, Bill, just go up there and talk. And I went, so when I was new or really young, I went, what do you mean just go up there and talk? He says, you're a comedian. Your subconscious is going to find the punchline. That's what you do.
Wow.
That's what comedians do.
Yeah.
And he's right. I mean, you went on stage when someone heckles or asks you a question, does something, and then you start going, and then all of a sudden these like gems are coming out. Where was that?
Right.
Why couldn't I tap into that well, with my conscious mind?
Right.
Well,
I go back to when you're just starting out and you're starting to go on, you're doing, you've been a doctor and you're being a comedian. Your parents are like, what's with Mashiba and Billy? Why is he doing that?
It was a lot more than what's with Mashiba and Billy. It was like, what are you doing? You're shaming us. What are you doing?
Oh, God.
Yeah, there was an article. Yes, my parents are Holocaust survivors. So,
yeah. And where in New York, my grandma was a Russian concentration camp survivor from the event.
Yeah, we...
Before Hitler invented it. Where do they live in New York?
We lived in Washington Heights, 176th and Broadway.
Okay, yeah. Okay. What did they
do? Yeah.
They didn't like it.
Well, no, they liked it. My dad was in, his family in Europe was in the garment trade.
Mm-hmm.
So he started that, working for somebody, and then he opened up a factory himself and started working, for himself, making women's coats. And then he got burned out after a few years, and he got like a rooming house, a hotel kind of thing, him and another guy. And then he didn't like that, so he went back to the garment trade. And he had a factory in Bradley Beach, right next to Asbury Park. So we used to go there in the summers. I mean, and then after a couple of years, he sold that and didn't know what he wanted to do. My mother had a cousin who was living in L.A. And the cousin said, you know, Henry, that's my dad's name, rest in peace. He said, hey, Henry, come out to California for a visit. So he went in December, and it was 81 degrees. And it was beautiful. And he came back and he said, we're going to California. And everyone said, what? He said, if I can make X amount of money in New York, I'm going to go to California, even if I can only make half that.
Avoid California.
He did okay. You know, he provided for us. You know, I got to hand it to him. So, and then we went to LA and he opened a factory in Glendale, and he had that for like 20 something years. Making women's coats.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So now eventually, when you started to progress and you said, look, this is not what I'm doing. You're showing that you can do both. What did they say?
They still thought, they looked upon it like not, you know, my dad said to me, you know, because he liked comedians. He liked Buddy Hackett. He liked Don Rickles. You know, we love comedians. And my parents were very, very funny. You know, hysterical.
Of course they were very funny, both of them.
Yeah, no, they are. They were hysterical.
Mom, my mom would, you know, all of ours were.
they do. You're absolutely right. So he said to me, he said, you know, look, are you thinking you're going to be Don Rickles? To be mediocre, anyone could be mediocre. I said, what? Well, how do you never saw my show? How do you know? You know, I've killed. I've gotten standing ovation, you know? Yeah. And so anyway, when I had my kids, that's when I did my hiatus.
Yeah.
More or less. You know, I would do a local gig once in a while, but, you know, I stopped going on the road. I didn't want to be an absentee dad. Some of my comedian friends, they went on the road for a month. They come back. Two things happen. The kids don't know who they are. They get like frightened. Who's that? And then there's someone else having dinner with the mother. You know what I mean? So I didn't want to be that absentee dad. And so then I kind of put it aside and raised my kids and did everything the right way. Mm-hmm. You know, I bought a house in the suburbs. My parents would come visit, you know, it was a nice house. And they'd go, oh, I'm very proud of you, son. You know, well, you could have told me when I got on the television shows that I got on. You know, he didn't say that. I thought that. I didn't tell it to him. Yeah, yeah. So, toward the end of his life, my mother, she realized that I'm doing both. And she goes, you like it? You're having a good time? Good for you. Because mm-hmm. she saw that I was a good father and a good family, you know, a husband while it lasted. And I provided for my kids. So she couldn't say anything. You know, they went to college, they had, you know, they got bar mitzvah, so they did everything that you're supposed to do if you're a Jewish dad, and, you know, for your kids. And they did all that. So
did you raise them in LA or Chicago?
Chicago. My oldest daughter was almost three, or she was three when we moved. And my younger daughter, my middle child, she was born in May, and we moved there in July or August. I went there in July to start the training program. I went back to retrain. I was what they call grandfathered into board certification in emergency medicine. It was back when I started, it was it was in its infancy. It was a specialty and they needed board certified people. So if you did so many hours and did so many classes, you could challenge the boards. And I did, and I passed them and I got my boards there, but I got burned out and I went back to do anesthesia. The kids were raised.
When you took your hiatus, you were kind of cooking, right? You were doing shows, you said. You were doing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's hard to walk away, but also not hard at the same time. You know, how'd you reconcile that a little bit?
Well, here's the thing. It's when you're on the road and doing a lot of shows, you're sharp. It's like a major leaguer playing every day. You know what I mean? You come, bring it. I got this. Bring it. Okay. And then I started doing, when my daughter was born, I didn't want to go on the road. I started working more as a doctor because I wanted to provide, you know, for my family. You know, as you know, as a comedian, you could be, you know, 6-7 weeks in a row, you're on the road. All of a sudden, you got nothing coming in for 2 weeks, you know, 3 weeks.
Yeah, no, you know what's interesting, real quick, just so you understand, my head is I was off and on since I'm 19. And then before, just as my kids got born, I was doing a full like year and a half going up, you know, and I, those pitches were getting slow. And I'm able to like, everything just slows down and you're able to go, oh, I could do this, I could do that. And I was like, you know, there's two ways I can go here. Kids are already, you know, they were like one and three. And I was like, I said, I either have to do this every night and write every day to try to be the best I can. And I also had a business. And I said, I gotta take the business and double down on the business. And I took a long hiatus. I did stay up on maybe like 3 or 4 months ago just because I knew I was gonna start a little business and I said, I have a window, you know?
Yeah.
And now I'm off again. So I was never really, you know, like that, but this is a big subject because Eddie Brill was talking to me one time and he's like, I'm a happy guy. You know, I don't have any regrets for choosing this life. He's a booker for anybody who doesn't know.
Yeah, I know he is. Yeah.
You know, for the Letterman show. And I was like, why are you, I was thinking, he's telling me that because he's maybe kind of second guessing a little bit, you know, because it's always a thing to choose, you know, because comedians,
yeah,
you go all in.
You have to go all in, but, you know, some of the guys that I started with in LA, Mike Binder, you know, he was saying, he said, you know, to be, and at that point, Carson, like if a good comedian went on Carson, you know, and had a great show, they would pop and they're like, boom, now you're in the next, you know, you're up there. That started not happening that much. There were a lot of good comedians that went on Carson and it wasn't that big catapult. And he said, you know, to be the next guy that pops on Carson, you know, it doesn't happen as often as it did, you know, years prior. So he started writing. And then I thought, you know, same thing that you were thinking of. I got kids, you know, what do I want to do? So I started doing a lot of hospital stuff. I would do a lot of hospital staff parties and the annual doctors, you know. So I did those and I started getting, I got booked. One company hired me. They owned 110 hospitals. And I would, every couple of weeks, I would do a show. They'd fly me and I'd do the show. The good thing is the money was very lucrative. The bad thing is, you know, you got stage time where, you know, I'm working now 45 minutes a month or 45 minutes every 3 weeks instead of 45 minutes a night, 5 nights a week.
But you got the staying shape a little bit.
A little bit, but I still, you know, and then like, you know, when I got the last stop in Newport Beach, you know, I was a little rusty, you know, not rusty, but I wasn't as sharp as I was, you know, the last, and I saw, and that was frustrating. So I said, I either got to jump all in and do like what I call the showbiz residency. I was going to try and not go on the road as a comic, but try and get a job in production. Cause you know, as comedians, we have great ideas. We, you know, punch stuff up. And I didn't mind doing that. I produced a short film with a friend of mine. You know, I kind of like that. As long as you got the creative process going, that was okay with me. And I thought, okay, I got this daughter, I got a wife, and I got to, you know, pay all the bills. And how am I going to do that? And I thought, you know, and I actually, you know, sat down with paper and pencil and tried to do soul searching. And I said, look, I would hate myself if I went one way. It didn't work out the way I had hoped it went because, you know, showbiz is a crapshoot no matter how you are. If you could be, you know, diligent, you know, you can make some kind of living, you can grind out a living, you can get a job lashing out somewhere. But to make the kind of impact in showbiz that I wanted to make, and I'm sure you wanted to make, it's still, let's roll the dice. And I looked at my daughter and I didn't want to roll her dice.
Right.
You know, I mean, I'll roll my dice. I could eat tuna. I don't care.
Right.
I don't want her to, you know what I mean?
Right.
I didn't want to roll her dice. Let her roll her dice, not me. Yeah. So I said, okay, I'll do it. And, you know, I didn't want to say a part of me died, but a part of me hibernated. Right. You know, so I went back because I always wanted to be in showbiz or something else where I could, you know, orate, you know, a lawyer, even a lawyer. But so I worked as a doctor and, you know, I'm glad I did. And I tried to use my personality, my comedic sense to try and, you know, I had an audience of one every time I was with a patient, you know, and if I could see, you know, what they were, I could maybe get a smile out of them. Yeah, I still got it.
Yeah.
And then when the kids were grown, I started working Zanies again. And then they started hiring me, and I started working. They hired me as feature again. Then I started headlining Zanies and working the other clubs and, in Chicago.
Zanies, by the way, on YouTube, 4 years ago, you posted it. Great sets, you know, on there.
Oh, thank you.
I suggest seeing it, everybody. It's really good.
Thanks. Thanks a lot. And yeah. I just did a show at the hospital where I used to work. Daytime show, because I have a company now. I started a Dr. Bill's Traveling Medicine Show, where laughter is the best medicine.
Nice, yeah.
So we're bringing that to hospitals, their facilities, medical conventions, you know, annual conventions, and other affiliated industry functions. So,
you know. Now, you're performing on stage. You're active right now, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I'm asking this because, you know, I kind of sense a little bit of a change. When I was younger, I mean, a lot of my, you know, being Jewish, you know, I'd be able to talk about it and no problem. Now, you know, recently, you know, it seems like, you know, you can't even like mention anything, and then you're getting a bunch of comments in the section because of everything that's going on. Have you felt any heat lately?
Yeah. Yeah. You can't do anything. But you know, I figure now I'm not comparing myself to any great artist. Okay. I'm just saying that when Van Gogh or Warhol or any of the artists that you like, and when they sit there with their easel and the canvas, they're not saying, are they going to like this shade of blue? Yeah. Should I put a little orange there? No, someone's going to not like this. They don't say that. They go, I'm putting the blue here, I'm putting the orange there, and that's what I'm doing. But I mean, that this Me Too movement just got a little, and this cancel culture, I know a lot of comedians that don't want to go to colleges anymore because they do a joke, the crowd goes, because they think they're not supposed to laugh. You know, it's like, oh, I can't do that. That's all, ooh. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
And it gets to the point where you don't know what to say. I used to do a joke where, you know, after my divorce, I wanted to break the ice, but, you know, with all the talking to women, but with all the Me Too movement, you don't know what to say. Like, if you see a woman eating an apple, you can say, hey, nice looking apple. But if she's eating a pear, you can't say that.
Nice. That's clean. This would be cute. You know?
Yeah, it's cute, but you can't say, yeah, I don't do the joke anymore because I'm way past the divorce and I'm with someone, so it's other jokes. But I'm saying, you know, you can't, you just don't know, you don't know how to, what to say. You know, you don't know what to say. People come in and they start telling you their pronouns.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where'd that come from?
Well, you know, being Jewish, you know, like you got that good joke, you know, did your parents a doctor Jewish, you know, and all that. And then it can't even do that now this week, you know, because of like everybody wants to be like, you know, openly, like everybody can be openly racist now against with Jews or something.
Right.
You know, it seems like it's okay. It's like, how do you get through that? Just don't do that. You say fuck it, or I'm gonna work that into, you know, some guys, you know, are navigating it. Like let's say Nikki Glaser, she's not. She had this amazing set, but she doesn't say saying that I'm Jewish, and a lot of the racist Jews don't know that she's Jewish anyways. So she's navigating it that way, you know, which is fine. But have you ran into some issues lately? Just because, but Bob Miller,
no,
whose name,
no. No, I haven't done. I used to say, you know, I'm Jewish. You know, like my line was, I'm a doctor and a comedian. You know, how is that possible? You know, I became a doctor because my parents are Jewish and they made me.
Yeah.
You know, and I started doing comedy because I'm a bad doctor.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the only thing I talked about being Jewish. I had some other stuff about being Jewish about that I would bring medical school. You know, like my parents spent a lot of money for my education. And they ask me for advice and don't take it because all they have is chicken soup and that'll cure everything, you know? And I started telling that in morning rounds. My classmates are all smart. You know, they're studying every night and I'm at the comedy clubs trying to get stage time. And then what do you think that, you know, doctor, and they're saying, well, this is an efficacious study. And I think this would probably be advantageous to give her the try a short course of antibiotics. And Dr. Miller, what do you think? I think chicken soup would work real good here. You know,
those are great jokes. And I think that up until like, you know, like 7 months ago, you know, like there wasn't really that much of a problem to say that stuff.
No, but I just, you know, when I was younger, I would get in people's faces. Okay.
Yeah.
And I didn't mind. I don't mean literally, but I mean, I wasn't afraid. You know, yeah, I'm Jewish. We can say about it. Come on, talk to me now. You know, I got the light and the mic. Go ahead, say something.
Yeah.
But the older I get, you know, I want a good set. I want the crowd to like me.
Right.
I want the booker to say, hey, that was a good set. Why don't you come back? You know? So unfortunately, you have to sometimes. But now if somebody starts something, well, bet your ass I'll finish it. But I'm not going to go, you know, promoting.
Right.
Well, a stereotype.
The majority of people are not like that, you know, and it's really a fringe, you know, thing. So, you know, this will pass. This, not to sound like our philosopher, but this will shall too pass.
You know, that's what they said 2,000 years ago, mm-hmm. And we're still waiting. Okay, we're still waiting.
It goes in waves. We're going through a rough wave. It'll always be the malaise will maybe always be there, but hopefully this wave will kind of dissipate. We had a good run there for a while, didn't we? In the 80s, 90s.
Yeah, we had a really good run, but, you know, I don't want this to sound anything but objective. I heard the ambassador to the Middle East, one of the countries, spoke at the JUF in Chicago.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, why does he want to speak and why is he proud to be a Jew? He said something about the chosen people. Why were the chosen people? He said, we are 0.1%. 0.1% of the world's population, mm-hmm. Yet we have 2/3 of the Nobel Prizes. Okay, so, and as long as we're keep doing that, you know, we're overachievers, we're successful. We're based. Our whole familial structure is based on you got to be better than me. Whatever I'm doing, if I'm a bricklayer, you're going to be a better bricklayer than me. And your kid's going to be better than you. Otherwise, you know, that's our whole legacy, right?
Right, right.
Education and to be a mensch, all right? And as long as we keep doing that, people who don't want to do that are going to say, what the fuck are they doing? Look, yeah. they got everything. Well, we're working for it. We're not sitting around, you know, cracking a 40 every day. You know, I mean, it's, I don't know.
I have a routine that I've been toying around with writing lately. And that is throughout history, it's like, why are Jews hated? So it's like, wait, one religion, one guy? You know, fuck those guys. And then everything throughout history, it's like, fuck those guys. You know, because like, wait, you know, you're a small group and you're very successful. Well, fuck those guys. You know, it's like, it goes on and on and on, you know, throughout history. It's kind of like a lesson. And I know we can't write a book that says Jews, yeah, fuck those guys. But it's like,
but you could write a book that says, fuck those guys. That's a very interesting topic because you can go throughout history, you know, I mean, all the way, and you can end it with, you know, now, or you can end it with the 19th. Was it June 19th in Tulsa?
What was in
those? That was the Black Wall Street.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they were very successful. Look at them. Fuck those guys. That's
right.
You know, that's what it is. And it's fuck those guys. But then the tag or the corollary is like, what, you want me to go work that hard? No, fuck those guys. Right. They're making me look bad. If they're working, fuck those guys. Right? That's the way I see it. Right. And that's why people don't like someone. Because they make them reflect on themselves and the result is bad.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I don't. It's funny is that you talk about anti-Semitism and stuff, you rarely see it. Asians have, especially Chinese, have the same kind of ethic, work ethic as our people, I believe. You know, they work hard, they stress education, and the kids got to be better. You know, number one son is better than me, number, you know, all the way that. You never hear them going, oh, fuck those guys.
There's a lot of Asians. A small group.
There are.
I think a small group that sticks out is.
No, I mean, the Asians. The Asians don't say fuck us.
Well, not North Basis only. Met Mel.
That's true. That's true.
I actually love Asian culture because it's one built on a lot of it's built on honor and integrity.
But not the brush. Like being a mensch.
Yeah. You know, especially I love Japanese culture because that's so much. Everything is everything you hear and see is always based on on honor.
Honor. Honor and yeah.
So. Tough subject, but I thought we're talking about another once, but I thought I'd address it in a comedian and how you have to navigate through that stuff. It's interesting times. So what's for the future for you? Like, what do you got planned? And the next, did you plan? You're a doctor, you probably plan out the next 5 to 10. You know, what do you?
No, I don't plan out 5 to 10 years. I tell you, I just started this thing. I just started the Dr. Bill's Traveling Medicine Show, and we filmed at the hospital Wednesday. Putting together a sizzle reel, and we're gonna start marketing that. Yeah. Where we bring the funny to you. We'll bring the funny to you by Zoom. We'll bring it in person. We'll bring it to your function, to your facility, to your event. And I did several hospital Zoom shows, and I used some well-known comedians. Marshall Warfield, Rich Scheidner, Anna Ferrara.
She had to remember HBO.
Yeah.
She's talking about the desert that brings you some wheat. She said, "You ever try to eat some dry fucking wheat?" That's a great, great joke. I don't know if it was, but there was like 1980 or mid-80s. She was on a special.
She's had a student. I know Marsha 40 years. We were very good friends. We're still good friends.
Yeah,
she's great. Yeah. So that's the future for me. I got some shows, local shows up here. A little while ago, I headlined the Improv. I got a show coming up at CG's Comedy Club in Bolingbrook. And then some showcase places at the Laugh Factory, some showcase spots.
What a wonderful situation you made for yourself. Wonderful career, and you got to do it on your terms, which a lot of comedians don't get to do. I think it's fantastic. Please tell everybody they can find out more about you.
Well, I got a website, drbillcomedy.com. You can email me, it's DR, not the word, drbill@drbillcomedy.com. And I got a website there. You can look at some shows coming up, although I'm really lax for updating. I'm kind of procrastinator, which is not really good for a doctor. You shouldn't procrastinate. But I got to update, tell my IT person. I got an IT person. Everyone has a guy for that. Mm-hmm. I got an IT guy. Mm-hmm. He's got to upgrade the thing. And that's how you can find out about me.
You should really check out his material and what he's doing. It's really tight. You're using some of your superpowers, your doctor skills, great writing, and there's not a lot of fat in the routine. It's really nice. And all that, those reps that you've done, you can tell it is. Your LPMs, the last four minutes, that this guy's getting on and how tight it is. I'm like, oh, listen, maybe some of that medical career actually helped you and vice versa. So it was a pleasure. And
thank you.
I look forward to hearing more about you in the future.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure, Michael. Thank you for having me on the show. And let's stay in touch.
Absolutely.
All right. That's a wrap for today's episode. We hope you enjoyed our adventure and we inspired you to go on your own. Special thanks to our sponsor, Bolitor. Remember, whether you're trekking through the wilderness or commuting to work, Bolitor's unique backpacks and outdoor gear ensure you're always prepared for the journey. Check it out at bolitor.com. That's BOLOTOR.com. Check it out and gear up for your next adventure. Until next time, stay curious and keep on exploring.